Good morning. My name is Thomas Lund, and I am a member of JRUUC. It is good to be together again and to be reminded that our beloved community lives and breathes, not only within the walls of our building at the corner of 4th and East Johnson, but beyond as well. This is a virtual space of radical love, and we are so glad you're here. Whatever the color of your skin, what you believe in, where you come from, how you got here, how you identify yourself, who or how you love, or how your body moves through space, we are glad you're here. Come, bring your heart, your hopes, your hands. You are welcome here. We especially welcome all of you who are worshiping with us for the first time. We're glad you're here, and we hope you'll come to our virtual coffee hour after the service for conversation. Just stay on this Zoom meeting to participate. And please visit our website if you would like to learn more about our congregation and Unitarian Universalism. You can find announcements on our website as well as on our Facebook page and through our weekly e-news. Please contact us at office@jruuc.org if you would like to receive our weekly email. Our service is being led today by our minister, the Reverend Karen Armina. If you have a joy or sorrow that you would like to share today, please send it to candle@jruuc.org or type it into the Zoom chat feature. We ask that you do this before the end of the message for all ages. We will read your joy or sorrow later in the service. We'll be inviting everyone to enable their video at the end of the service so we can see each other. We invite you into this virtual space with music. You may want to gather your home chalice or candle at this time so you can light it with us later in the service. Let us move now into our time of worship.
Good morning. Come, take a breath with me in and out. And another. Feel that breath moving into your lungs and know that I am breathing with you, that we are all breathing with each other in and out. Feel the air moving, cool on its way in to bring you life, warm on its way out to move beyond you. This is one of the ways we are connected, for the air moves like a fluid between us, dancing in response to our own movements and those of all of us. Come in to your breath, to your body, to all that moves within and between us, no matter where we are. Come and let us worship.
I invite everyone to light your chalices at home while Reverend Karen lights the Reeb chalice. The words for lighting our chalice come from the Reverend Scott Taylor. Come into the circle of compassion and care. Bring your worry and wounds, your longings and hope. With word and song, we rekindle the connection that soothes our tender hearts. With stillness and space to pause, we restore our strength for the work that must be done. The work of love, the work of waiting, the work of repair, the work of remembering we are not alone. Let us begin. Please join in our musical response, led today by Carol Neiman.
May the light which is before you nurture and sustain the light within you.
As Unitarian Universalists, we find wisdom and inspiration in many places: Jewish and Christian scriptures and other sacred texts, the arts, science, nature, our own experiences. Our tradition keeps us open to revelation from many sources. This morning's wisdom comes from our own tradition. Liz James is a blogger and a member of the Saskatoon Unitarians. She writes, "I'm not sure those tones people were being selfish in the stone soup story. You probably remember how it goes. When the old woman came into the village and asked for ingredients to make food, everyone said they had nothing. She began boiling a pot of water with a stone in it, and she said, 'Oh, I wish I had a little salt.' And someone came forward shyly with a tiny bit tucked away in a pocket. Then she wondered out loud if she could find a few root vegetables, and another person had that. Someone else had a few spoonfuls of rice, and so on, until a glorious soup was made." We're taught that this tale is about tricking a meal out of selfish people, but I don't really think that's what happened. I mean, if someone asked me if I had a meal to share with them, and I only had a half teaspoon of salt or a few old vegetables that are always at the back of my fridge, I would say I couldn't help. I wouldn't be lying when I said I had nothing to give. I'd just be wrong. When we say that there's nothing we can do, we're not lying. That phone call we might make, that $5 we might donate, that quick email of encouragement we might send, these things feel so small that we think that they're the same as having nothing to offer. The stone soup story isn't about selfish people. It's about people who thought they were powerless. It's about people learning that they had something to offer that would feed themselves and each other.
Thank you, Thomas. I love it when people deconstruct stories like this to get at other possibilities of meanings or lessons. I have to admit that I've always heard this story with that scarcity mindset, assuming that the people in the village felt like they had to hold on to the very little they had because it wasn't enough for even them. This goes against what I know, though. The people in my life now who have little means are also the most generous people that I know. And yet, somehow I've learned to believe that there's never enough, that some have to go without, that sharing goes against my best interests. I've learned to believe that if someone doesn't have enough too, it's because they're not a productive member of society, and to value the accumulation of stuff for myself over the common good. And yes, I've learned that I'm powerless to change this. I've internalized all of that. And I'm constantly working on unlearning it all, on pushing back against the narrative of the meritocracy and embracing those first and seventh principles of our Unitarian Universalist faith, the inherent worth and dignity of all, and the interconnected web of which we are all a part in a practical and an immediate way. Through the lens that Liz James shares, this story helps me to do exactly that. It's really about several things. The first is, as she names, we need to learn that we are not powerless, that the things that we have that seem insignificant can be offered into a co-creative process to build amazing new realities, that maybe each of us individually can't feed someone else for a time, but that together, we are more than enough. That we have all, that we all have to learn to see the patriarchal, racist, consumerist system for what it really is, a structure built and maintained to support the belief that some lives matter more than others, to keep the money and the power in the hands of a few at the expense of the rest. And that we have to learn to unlearn the false narrative that each person is solely responsible for their own survival and success, and see the reality that we are deeply dependent on one another, that we all need one another for all of us to thrive. We do not know what might emerge when we gather with purpose and allow the space for resourcefulness and creativity. I'm using the term emerge here in a way that Adrienne Marie Brown, a Black queer activist who wrote the book Emergent Strategy, does. The basic premise is that of emergence, which leadership consultant Nick Obolensky defines as the way complex systems and patterns arise out of the multiplicity of relatively simple interactions. In other words, those small things that happen between us as we interact with each other combine to become complex patterns and systems. Like in a forest, different species of trees grow at different rates, until in a mature forest there are trees of all different sizes and all different heights. They interact with each other in lots of ways, roots intertwining to share and to compete for water and nutrients, canopies spreading out among each other, stretching out so the widest and tallest trees get the most light, which of course they need to make food. But a forest isn't just the trees. There are animals that eat leaves and eat seeds that impact which trees might survive and which ones might thrive. And there are insects, some of which also eat or damage leaves, and some of which can actually do so much damage under the bark of a tree that it can eventually kill it. Other insects pollinate the tree's flowers in the spring, helping to create the seeds that will become the next generation in the forest. And mushrooms that reach their mycelia or their roots into live wood that can also eventually kill a tree, or into dead wood to help decomposition happen, which releases nutrients into the forest floor to feed all of the other plants there. Each of these parts is relatively simple, and in their interaction create a complex ecological system, and we are like that too. Compassion can emerge in a system when we practice it in our own relationships. And we practice it in our relationships by being able to see ourselves and our humanity in others, as Adrienne Marie Brown also writes. I don't know if you know about the Charter for Compassion. It's an organization that offers people ways to do exactly that, to build a thriving ecosystem of compassionate action as a force for change, by encouraging people to make commitments, to live by the principles of the Golden Rule, by pioneering efforts in compassionate action, by supporting the development of networks and their capacity for innovative, collaborative action, and by creating opportunities to learn and share experiences, helping people to shift from being isolated individuals and groups to developing these communities of practice and learning. So one of the foundational principles of the Charter for Compassion is that true compassion is the ability to engage in the suffering of others. Which brings me to the second thing that Liz's frame helps me to see, that compassion can work wonders. And I'm talking here about the visitors to the village. They didn't leave in defeat after being turned away from house after house. Instead, they drew the best out of the villagers. I don't want to project what they were actually feeling, but they certainly acted in a compassionate way, helping those people in the village realize they had more to offer than they had known, and showing them what can happen for the common good when they realize what a big contribution what they thought of as unworthy could actually be. So the feeling of compassion might not be enough to move us into action, especially if we're feeling powerless. There's so many things that can get in the way of offering what we have, including believing that we don't have anything to offer. The action might require a catalyst, like the travelers coming to the village. Sometimes we have more to give than we think. And sometimes what we have to offer is completely useless to us because of circumstances beyond our control, like those ridiculous spoons. But they can make a world of difference to someone else. It's a two-step process. We hear over and over that self-compassion is necessary to nurture the ability to feel compassion for others. Most of the time when I hear this, I take it to mean it's necessary to engage in the practice of being easier on myself, less critical, to learn to build up that muscle of compassion so I can use it in my interaction for others, with others. And that is true. And then people like Liz remind me that there are frames other than mine. James Baldwin, the African-American writer and activist, wrote in his book, The Fire Next Time, "White people in this country will have quite enough to do in learning how to accept and love themselves and each other. And when they have achieved this, which will not be tomorrow and will not be today and may very well be never, the Negro problem will no longer exist, for it will no longer be needed." And that strikes a chord for me. The systems that we live within were built by white men through their frame to provide for the means to keep the wealth and power they had built up for themselves. They created the Negro problem so that they wouldn't have to deal with it. Those systems are supported by the continuing messages of capitalism and meritocracy. Those who can show their success materially must deserve it, and I must work to become like them. And those who can't show material success must not want to work for it. What compassion can offer into this system is the ability to see beyond those systems, into the disparities in the opportunities for the material success that many don't have. And that starts with self-compassion. If we, and by we, I mean specifically me and others the systems were built for, if we can learn to understand that we really are enough, that we really have enough, we can learn to stop being distracted by the next shiny thing we need to have to feel good about ourselves. We can learn to accept who we are and come to terms with the terrible things our ancestors did to claim this land for their own. And we can move forward to build new systems that are more just. We can come to understand that disparities are built into the systems and that it's the systems that need to be changed. These times are hard. We're afraid. If not for ourselves, then for loved ones and unknown ones and our whole human race. For me, this pandemic, is a visceral reminder of things I already know, but I push into the background and the busyness of keeping on, keeping on. Reminders that life is short. That in my efforts to keep myself safe and comfortable and feeling successful, I forget that I'm already safe and comfortable and successful. That there are things I can do to ensure the means for my siblings of color to also be safe and comfortable and successful. Our Unitarian Universalist theology tells us that we are all worthy of love no matter what, and that we can rest in that love, knowing that it is enough and that we are enough. And so when we experience the feeling of compassion, it can be a reminder that we're part of the web, that everyone else in it has worth and is deserving of dignity, and that we have the means to make that a real lived experience for all. May it be so, and may we be so. It does my heart such good to see that. Know, as we can see each other, know that just like in our physical sanctuary, this virtual space through which we now connect is also made sacred by our presence and our intention. May we hold the love, the courage, and the strength that we learn and practice together and do everything we can to move them out into the world, knowing that we have enough and that we are enough. Go in peace, blessed be, and amen. I invite you to extinguish your home chalice as I extinguish our reed chalice.